The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, this is Susan, and I have for you some articles from the May 2026 issue of National Geographic magazine. Our first article, believe it or not, is called The Global Hunt to Unlock the Healing Powers of Poop, written by Adam Paiore. The first Bejiao volunteers pulled up in canoes around 11 a.m., and gathered on a rickety wooden balcony surrounded by the turquoise expanse of the Sulu Sea. They were the intrepid ones. Over the previous week, word had spread through the settlement of roughly 200 adults and children living in houseboats and wooden huts perched above the ocean just off Mabul, a tiny island northeast of Borneo. A team of outsiders was coming to visit with an unusual offer. For centuries, the Bejiao Laut, a mostly stateless indigenous group sometimes referred to as sea nomads, have lived an itinerant life on the water, hunting tuna with spears, diving for spider conchs, abalone, and sea cucumbers, and dusting their faces with cooling powders made from rice and pandan leaves. In recent years, they have drawn the interest of scientists for their exceptionally large spleens, which allow them to hold their breath underwater for as long as 13 minutes, a unique adaptation to the abundant ocean ecosystem that has sustained them for generations. But the research team that arrived this past October from Germany's Kiel University and Malaysia's University Malaya had come to gather information about an entirely different kind of ecosystem. They were there to learn about the vast community of unseen organisms living on the skin and inside the digestive tracts of the Bejiao themselves. The team would compensate volunteers for their time, but as a translator conveyed to the roughly 20 villagers gathered on the balcony that morning, that offer came with an unconventional request. The researchers had come to collect feces, and they take as much of it as each volunteer could muster. Plastic bowls would be handed out shortly. The request was met with giggles and jokes that belied the stakes of the mission. Scientists finally have the tools to study the trillions of invisible organisms that reside within us, the microscopic world known collectively as the microbiome. And in recent years, they've made some alarming discoveries. The industrialized world has reshaped the human microbiome to be far less diverse and resilient than that found in the guts of individuals living more traditional lifestyles, like the Bejiao people. That insight, along with a growing number of studies suggesting changes in the composition of the gut microbiome, often accompany many chronic maladies, has raised urgent concerns, especially as isolated places may not remain that way forever. The question is whether the diseases that we have now that are skyrocketing in prevalence, like obesity, like diabetes, like liver disease, some forms of cancer, even some neurological diseases like multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's, are in part due to deficiencies of microbes that we can resupply, says Rob Knight, a computational microbiologist and microbiome pioneer who directs the Center for Microbiome Innovation at the University of California, San Diego. That last part, resupplying, is critical. If remote cultures across the globe have stronger, healthier more diverse microbiomes, could they help us cure diseases? Would collecting and then using their microbes even work? And what are the ethics of taking someone's poop, even if the inventions are good? Eager to answer those questions and more like them is the Global Microbiome Conservancy, GMBC, an international consortium of scientists building a biobank of fecal samples from the world's most remote populations and a library composed of tens of thousands of individual bacterial strains derived from each stool specimen. The GMBC has been at it for almost a decade, collecting gut bacterial samples from non-industrialized populations in Europe, North America, Africa, and Asia. From Tanzanian tribespeople to Inuit in the Arctic Circle, while hoping to document the evolution of human microbiomes across the globe. In the process, it aims to better understand the impact of industrialization, processed diets, and antibiotic use on human health. The stakes couldn't be higher. Globally, more than 10 million people suffer from inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, chronic inflammation in the gut that manifests as ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. In recent years, evidence linking the onset of those two conditions to abnormalities in the gut microbiome has steadily grown. Differences in gut microbiome composition have also been found in those suffering from a wide array of other conditions, from autism and type 2 diabetes to heart failure, cancer, anxiety, arthritis, and more. Long believed to be expendable microbial hitchhikers picked up at random, many of the bacteria living inside us, particularly in our guts, are now understood to be critical players in the complex, holistic systems that govern human health. Many co-evolved with us over millions of years and operate like microscopic chemical factories, essential for healthy development and the efficient functioning of the human body. And yet, there's still so much to learn, including one key mystery: whether or not microbial changes are the cause or the result of a wide array of connected diseases. The possibilities that could be unlocked by the GMBC's work are tantalizing. But first, it needs to find more poop. The GMBC's growing fecal archive, housed in a series of freezers in the recently established Kiel Microbiome Center in Germany, currently contains close to 2,000 stool samples from some 50 human communities worldwide, ranging from urban centers in industrialized countries to remote villages. Each stool sample has been genetically sequenced, revealing the presence of thousands of bacterial species never before seen, studied, or named. From this biobank, nearly 10,000 bacterial strains, representing roughly 600 species groups, have been cultured, isolated, sequenced, and made available to scientists around the world. Overseeing this burgeoning Alexandria Library of Poop are Mathieu Groussin and Mathilde Poyer, the French husband and wife team who first conceived of the GMBC. Their goal is to increase inclusion of underrepresented human populations in microbiome science and to characterize the full biodiversity of the human gut microbiome as it exists across the globe. Groussin and Poyer were postdocs at MIT when they first got the idea to create the GMBC, after reading a high-profile 2014 scientific paper that detailed the lifestyle, diet, and microbiome of a remote tribe of Tanzanian hunter-gatherers known as the Hadza. The Hadza's lifestyle is similar to that of early humans, who lived at a time when, presumably, evolutionary forces shaping the human microbiome were strongest. To collect the fecal samples, a team led by researchers from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, traveled to the shores of Lake Eyasi in northern Tanzania's Rift Valley. The 27 Hadza tribespeople who provided fecal samples had little exposure to modern antibiotics and soaps and lived on a diet of honey, berries, baobab fruit, tubers, antelope, monkeys, bush pigs, baboons, and any number of other targets of opportunity that could be foraged, scavenged, or hunted. As a reference, the researchers also surveyed the microbiomes of 16 Italians living in Bologna, along with samples from rural farming groups in Burkina Faso and Malawi. The differences in their microbiomes were stark. The Hadza had far higher levels of microbial richness and biodiversity than the Italian urban control group and the African farm dwellers. In comparison, the Western microbiome looked as depleted and diseased as that of an IBD patient, a difference, the researchers suggested, with potentially dire consequences for anyone living in a more modernized world. Humans and their microbes have evolved in tandem over millions of years, with microbes influencing everything from digestion to our personalities. One microbe found in Africa helps people access energy-providing compounds from tough, fibrous tubers. Another found in Japan allows its human host to extract complex carbohydrates from seaweed. Some microbes send signals that can speed up or slow down metabolism. Others produce essential vitamins, influence appetite, regulate blood sugar, and help train and support our immune system. Newer evidence suggests our microbiomes can even alter our brains, promoting extroversion, influencing mood, and determining how we respond to stress. But the widespread use of antibiotics and antimicrobial soaps, along with changes to our diet, has eliminated many of our allies. The loss of microbial diversity, the Max Planck researchers suggested, has had a drastic effect on health and human and immune function of modern westernized human groups. Grusin and Poirier were uniquely qualified to dig deeper into the focus of the paper. Grusin, a computational biologist, specializes in genomics and evolution. Poirier, an expert in experimental microbiology and ecology, focuses on more practical matters. She had built one of the world's first microbiome biobanks, from 11 healthy fecal microbiota transplant donors to treat people in hospitals suffering from Clostridium difficile, C. diff infections, which can cause diarrhea and colon damage. But to tackle the questions raised by the Hadza research, they'd need more data. Specifically, a lot more poop from a lot more places. They pitched their mentor, Eric Alm, MIT professor of biological engineering, on the idea in 2016, and he agreed to provide the funding. The Global Microbiome Conservancy was official. A few months later, Poirier and Grusin boarded a plane headed for Yaoundé, Cameroon. They visited rural villages without electricity and documented the daily struggles locals faced in finding sources of healthy food. It was an abrupt and sobering introduction to reality for the two French scientists, who'd rarely ventured outside the lab. In the months that followed, they climbed the mountains of Nepal to get samples from Himalayan villagers, distributed those telltale plastic bowls to Inuit communities in the Arctic Circle, and trekked deep into the jungles of northern Thailand to collect poop from remote hill tribes. They encountered soldiers manning machine guns mounted on pickup trucks in the Central African Republic and dangerous elephants in Tanzania. They gingerly removed a poisonous scorpion when it jumped into Grusin's shirt. A massive snake consumed several chickens outside their tent. In Rwanda, their presence attracted a crowd of curious locals that grew so large, the researchers' security team peeled out while Poye was still sitting in the back of their vehicle, attempting to process the fecal samples they'd just received. She held on tight and tried not to spill the stool soup all over herself. Slowly, the GMBC's collection grew. Today, in every country Grusin and Poye visit, they sample both rural and city dwellers to capture the influence of industrialization in each region. Already they have identified some promising, potentially transformative microbes. Among non-industrialized communities, Poye has isolated one microbe capable of turning cholesterol into coprostenol, a metabolite the body harmlessly excretes in stool. In some of the communities where the microbe is found in high concentrations, like the Hadza, cardiovascular disease barely exists. Because the GMBC's library is available to the scientific community, collaborators are using its vast collection of samples to drive further discoveries. For example, previous studies have shown that children who meet the clinical definition for obesity often have different microbiomes. But it's unclear whether the differences in their microbiomes are a cause of the obesity or if the changes come afterward. To find out, Yangia Jason Zhang, a pediatric gastroenterologist at Boston Children's Hospital, obtained stool samples from 200 children in Washington, D.C., none of whom were classified as obese. He looked for a risk factor strongly associated with the later onset of obesity, zeroing in on those who had reported episodes of what's known as loss of control eating. Genetic sequencing of their microbiomes revealed they had deficiency in a single key microbe, which Zhang then pulled from the GMBC's strain library and grew into colonies in the lab to study. The missing microbe, as he discovered and plans to publish this year, was excreting a lipid previous studies suggested could stimulate GLP-1 cells in mice, lowering their blood sugar and promoting a feeling of satiety. Think Ozempic, but all natural. These findings have profound implications for the treatment of diseases, potentially saving lives in the microbiome-depleted West and the rest of the world. The path forward, though, is anything but clear. Poye's discovery of a cholesterol-reducing microbe and Zhang's isolation of bacteria that may protect against obesity suggest an obvious next step: introducing those microbes, or combinations of beneficial microbes, into the guts of anyone who might benefit. Or, as UC San Diego's Knight suggests, treating any number of diseases by resupplying microbes that we have somehow lost, possibly bringing our industrialized and beleaguered microbiomes into healthier, more resilient states. That's where the artificial human guts come in. One warm morning last fall, Poye headed down a long corridor in the Keele University Life Sciences building, where the GMBC's collection resides. She had moved there from MIT in 2023. Poye strode into a fluorescent-lit wet lab with graduate students hunched over dishes. She stopped in front of two Rube Goldberg-like contraptions, each consisting of a large white console with a monitor above a pair of clear cylindrical glass containers buried beneath a jumble of white plastic tubing. "Here," she announced, "we have a bioreactor that is actually set up to mimic the human gut." In each of the lab's four artificial human guts, Poye can manipulate the environment to imitate the dynamic mix of gases, nutrients, liquids, and microbial composition present in a real human colon. The jumble of tubing allows Poye to deliver a continuous flow of new nutrients, and for the artificial guts to excrete waste at a pace representative of real-world conditions. In the process, she can perform a wide array of experiments on individual microbiomes. In one experiment, she recreated the gut of an IBD patient by seeding one of the glass receptacles with a bacterial community grown from stool samples provided by IBD patients treated at a local gastroenterology clinic. In the other three artificial guts, she used microbiomes derived from healthy individuals living in various stages of industrialization. Then she introduced oxygen into the normally anaerobic gut environment. This was followed by hydrogen peroxide, which is often released by colon cells in response to stress. Both gases are elevated in the guts of IBD patients and believed to drive chronic inflammation. In all four artificial guts, the compounds cause damage. But the more diverse microbiomes collected from non-industrialized communities return to normal faster than those from the more developed settings. The IBD patient's microbiome recovery was the most sluggish of all. How best to resupply the diseased microbiome in that glass container to improve its resilience is a conundrum that hangs over the heads of everyone in the field. Much of the basic science needed to understand the process by which individual microbes are able to successfully engraft in the human gut still needs to be worked out. MIT's Alm, for one, cautions that the ability to develop effective new drugs won't be immediate. We're far from simply swallowing a microbe-laced pill and fixing our industrialized depleted systems. There's this idea of we want to make these as drugs and just take a probiotic, and it's going to be the same as taking a regular small molecule drug, says Om. But nobody's done that. There's just a lot of basic research that people need to do before they try to make a drug to cure a disease. It's a lesson that Om has learned through experience. In 2021, Finch Therapeutics, a microbiome startup he helped found, went public and raised $128 million to fund a clinical trial for a therapy designed to treat C. diff, a deadly opportunistic bacterial infection. Finch also set to work developing treatments for ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, and autism spectrum disorder. 2 years later, Finch discontinued phase three trials and laid off 95% of its staff. Finch's failure was due in part to difficult biotech market conditions and the monumental costs of clinical trials. Alm suggests it was also brought down by a long list of unanswered questions surrounding appropriate dosing, which markers could be used to show therapies work in trials, and questions about how the resulting product might be manufactured. But there were also gaps in the foundational science, including an incomplete understanding of which nutrients and microbial neighbors might increase the chance of success for patients. Research has made clear that the microbial context of any given microbiome can vary widely across populations and individuals depending on lifestyle, environment, and a wide array of other factors, notes Grusin. Microbe applications are not one-size-fits-all, in the same way that human microbiomes are products of myriad factors, from genetics to culture to location. And that context can have a profound effect on the way any one person's microbiome and any specific microbe, particularly a newly introduced microbe, might interact. To better understand this context, Grusin and Poirier have been methodically screening each sample for markers associated with inflammation, which seems to be elevated in industrialized populations. They're studying how microbiomes of non-industrialized individuals transform when exposed to modern foods or medicines. and the GMBC maintains an active laboratory research program aimed at characterizing how different microbiomes behave under different conditions, including the introduction of new microbes. Where Finch Therapeutics didn't succeed, Grusin and Poirier may yet make a critical breakthrough, one that unlocks the seemingly undeniable potential for life-improving and possibly life-saving microbe-based therapies able to treat anything from Crohn's to cardiovascular disease. Of course, that would mean utilizing the microbes that the GMBC has collected from non-industrialized peoples across the globe. And that puts Grusin and Poirier's work in, well, a somewhat messy position. One of science's most glaring examples of exploitation was laid out in the best-selling 2010 book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which told the story of how a black woman, Lacks, had her cancer cells, taken during a biopsy in 1951, become the basis for decades of research and development for everything from mapping the human genome to developing polio and COVID-19 vaccines. Only in 2013, after years of legal battles, was her family granted control of the data stemming from her cells. In recent years, ethicists, scientists, and indigenous groups have been engaged in a robust debate about how best to ensure the subjects of microbiome studies aren't taken advantage of in the same way, and that fecal sampling isn't just the latest chapter in a long history of medical exploitation. Many argue that indigenous groups handing over samples deserve a say in research decision, rights to their own data, and financial benefits that might come from the sample's use. It's a nuanced quandary that the GMBC finds itself navigating amid all the work it's conducting on the ground and in the lab. The issue was thrust into the spotlight in 2014 when an archaeology writer and PhD candidate named Jeff Leach famously traveled to Tanzania, gave himself a rudimentary fecal transplant using a turkey baster filled with feces collected from the Hadza, and posted about it on his blog. It gained momentum 4 years later when Martin Blaser, a professor of the human microbiome at Rutgers University, argued in the journal Cell that humans should consider rewilding their microbiomes. Shortly after that, he and colleagues announced the formation of the Microbiota Vault, with a mission that sounds similar to the GMBC's. Billed as a Noah's Ark of beneficial germs, the Vault asks local researchers to share their collected fecal samples from communities that have been less exposed to antibiotics, processed diets, and bacteria-destroying soaps, so that it can warehouse copies of the samples in a central repository. Critics of the Microbiota Vault's process argue that there is no mechanism in place to ensure donors benefit from research derived from the data. Maria Gloria Dominguez Bello, a Rutgers microbiologist and director of the Vault, as well as Blaser's wife, believes the critiques stem from a misunderstanding. She says that only donors who have provided a sample to the Vault will have access to, and they must give consent before their samples are sequenced and uploaded to an open access database. Moreover, the Microbiota Vault, still in its early phases, has not yet stored any samples from indigenous peoples, though it has 1,200 samples from urban populations, and won't until it irons out the ethical issues. The GMBC, for its part, says it will only provide access to its samples to non-commercial entities and only for research purposes, and that ownership of the samples and the microbes continues to reside with the donors. In addition, both Grusin and Poirier have insisted from the start that neither they nor their umbrella institutions, first MIT and now Keele, will file patents for discoveries or claim ownership of the samples. The ownership of samples is left at the level of participants. Grusan says, in short, the Hadza, the Bajau, and every other group that has contributed to the GMBC's growing archive of poop remains the owners of all their unique gut organisms, not the scientists or anyone else. The GMBC says it shares samples only with scientists who forego the right to patent any derivatives. Even so, some suggest their protections do not go far enough. Matthew Anderson, an associate professor in genetics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who is of Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians descent, argues that both individual donors and their communities should be consulted each time their fecal sample is used for a new research project. In 2023, Anderson published a framework spelling out how such a process, which he uses in his own microbiome research, would work. Or, as National Geographic explorer Kiyulu Fox, a genome scientist and associate professor at UC San Diego, puts it, you can't just be bioprospecting on people's doo-doo, he says. Data is a resource. What is increasingly clear? Poop is powerful, and when it comes to microbiome medicine, feces, at least the information inside it, is the future. Just as the rainforests of the world have yielded a voluminous list of medicines derived from plants and exotic animal toxins, the unexplored ecology of the gut microbiome seems certain to contain new compounds with powerful biochemical properties. And much like efforts to protect those rainforests, the valuable debate over how to conduct fecal research is colliding with the urgency to act quickly. As globalization continues its relentless expansion into the farthest corners of the planet, traditional lifestyles like those of the Bajau are disappearing, and along with them, untold thousands of microbial species whose importance to human health and well-being scientists are only beginning to understand. We're just starting, says Grusan. We will find something. From the March issue of National Geographic, in the section at the very back of the magazine titled From the Vault, Artifacts from the National Geographic Archives, there is a photograph of a Muli saddle, circa 1920s, and the short article is titled A Souvenir from Shangri-La, written by Brian Kevin. Tibetan saddles can be high art, covered with ornate metalwork and inlaid jewels. This one, given to National Geographic explorer Joseph Rock about a century ago by a Lama warlord named Ziang Chicheng Zaba, is on the humbler side. But it was no less a treasure to Rock, an ethnographer and botanist with a taste for finery. In 1924, he became the first American to visit Muli, Ziang's isolated mountain kingdom. Ziang was a despotic ruler with a dungeon full of peasants, but he plied his visitor with tributes, among them a golden bowl and a leopard skin. Rock, perhaps not above flattery, praised Muli's bucolic splendor. In doing so, he likely inspired the fictional setting of the 1933 novel Lost Horizon, which captured Western imaginations with its depiction of a Tibetan utopia called Shangri-La. Discover this object, the saddle, and more at the new National Geographic Museum of Exploration opening summer of 2026. Also from the March issue, the kaleidoscopic beauty of hidden swamps. Deep in the inaccessible boglands of Russia, one photographer found a way to capture a stunning moment of change. Written by Jennifer Lemon. The abundant swamps speckled across Russia are constantly in flux, and more form each year. as an increasingly warming climate melts more of the permafrost covering roughly two-thirds of the country. Slumping soil creates a latticework of depressions that eventually fill with water and transform into cerulean ponds called thermokarst lakes. While some of Russia's marshes lie within an hour or two of major cities like St. Petersburg or Tver, they're still hard to get to, requiring specialized ATVs with oversized balloon-like tires to traverse the waterlogged terrain. Moscow-based wildlife photographer Alexei Karatonov first visited the bogs of the St. Petersburg region on the country's border with Finland 8 years ago, just looking for a weekend getaway. But what he found felt transformative. Suddenly, he says, you're in a wonderland. The blue water contrasting with the changing foliage prompted him to launch a drone and capture the psychedelic scenes from above. Every year since, he's traveled to swamps across the country to document the abstract beauty of these unexplored landscapes. As the seasons shift, so do the striking colors of the sphagnum moss that blankets central Russia's Orshinsky Moak Swamp. The rusty hues of the vegetation contrast with the still azure water. It almost looks like a carpet taken from the drone as you look down. Carpets of red sphagnum moss surround an electric blue pool of water in Mukhinskoye Swamp, a tangle of animal tracks visible atop the stagnant pond, were likely made by migrating ducks or geese. When Karatonov visited northern Russia's amber-hued Olenek River Valley, he became mesmerized by the colors of the Tamalir River and its old Oxbow Lake, a crescent-shaped body of water that forms when a wide bend in a river is cut off from the main stream. Shades of yellow, ochre, pink, red, blue, amazing contrasts in colors. In another photo, swaths of autumnal red sphagnum moss and golden grass pop next to green pines at the Mukhinskoye wetlands. Again from the March issue of National Geographic in the section titled Our World, Behind the Scenes with National Geographic. On a mission to save a delta unlike any other. In the crystal-clear water of a free-flowing river, we are reborn, ecologist and National Geographic explorer Steve Boies writes in Okavango and the Source of Life, Exploring Africa's Lost Headwaters, new from National Geographic Books. Boies, whose search for a mysteriously stealthy population of elephants is covered in this issue, in an article titled Searching for Ghosts, leads the Okavango Wilderness Project, a years-long effort to survey and protect Central Africa's critical Okavango Basin. With stunning photos and detailed maps, his book captures the wonders of a river system that supports a million people and countless extraordinary species. That's Stephen Boies's new book, Okavango and the Source of Life, Exploring Africa's Lost Headwaters, available from National Geographic Books. From the Our World section of the April 2026 volume of National Geographic magazine. New from National Geographic Books. The first one's titled Amazon by Thomas Peschak, P-E-S-C-H-A-K. National Geographic explorer Peschak's lavish photo book recounts a 4,000-mile journey from the Great River's icy Andean headwaters to the plume of fresh water it spills into the Atlantic. Along the way, we meet the stewards protecting the world's most critical river basin. The next book is Lost by Rachel Hartigan. What really happened to Amelia Earhart? Hartigan explores isolated Pacific islands, chases rumors of recovered bones, and interrogates the latest science to shed new light on persistent theories and paint a memorable portrait of the iconic aviator. The third book is titled Grizzled by Jason Bittell. In a series of insightful love letters to 50 of North America's least understood creatures, National Geographic explorer Bittell fields some zoological puzzlers. Why are beavers' teeth orange? Why can't cougars roar? The answers will deepen your appreciation for the wild. Coming this summer, 2026, the National Geographic Museum of Exploration. Opening in Washington, D.C., the Museum of Exploration will unlock your inner explorer. Discover immersive exhibits illuminating the wonders of our world, nearly 140 years of stunning photography, and inspiring stories from world-changing National Geographic explorers. Find details on exhibitions and events at moe.nationalgeographic.org. That's opening summer of 2026 in Washington, D.C. Scenes from a world-class museum in progress. Writer Richard Conniff spent nearly 2 weeks watching the race to prepare the Natural History Museum Abu Dhabi for its scheduled opening. The author of House of Lost Worlds, A Narrative History of the Yale Peabody Museum, he's seen behind the curtain at some of the world's great museums, but the scale of the effort in Abu Dhabi still wowed him. One memorable moment watching a technician working smarter, not harder, during an all-hands effort to lug fossils into an atrium, rolling a big brachiosaur foot across a room using an office chair. Around the World with Seven Changemakers. To photograph seven of the honorees from among this year's National Geographic 33 in the April issue, our annual list of extraordinary people making big impacts in conservation, science, and more, photographer Justin French traveled the globe. He hiked through a Scottish wood with actor Ewan McGregor, walked a California lakeshore with NBA All-Star Russell Westbrook, and explored an old mill in Mumbai, India, with actress Alia Bhatt, among other adventures. French, whose portraits of culture shapers appear in publications like The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and The Wall Street Journal, got a jolt of inspiration hearing his subjects talk about solutions to global problems, rather than about their day jobs. It was really nice being able to see this side of these people who are honestly megastars, French says. It's quite a comfort to hear them speak so passionately and so caringly. Follow at Nat Geo on Instagram to hear more from each of this year's National Geographic 33 on what moves them and keeps them motivated to help shape a better future. In the April issue, the back page of the magazine, there's a section titled From the Vault, Artifacts from the National Geographic Archives. And there's a photo of a Maytag oxygen mask invented in 1961. The article is titled A Mask Made for the Top of the World, written by Eric Wills. On his first climb in the Himalaya in 1960, Thomas Hornbein was left gasping for air. The 30-year-old American and future National Geographic explorer was a fit, capable climber. The problem was his clunky, multivalve oxygen mask. Hornbein, an anesthesiologist, set out to design a better one. By chance, he met a man who could manufacture it, Fred Maytag, appliance magnate and a patient at the hospital where Hornbein was a fellow. The result was made from a single piece of rubber with just one valve, and it was simple to de-ice. Hornbein breathed easier with it in 1963, when he joined the National Geographic-sponsored first American expedition to summit Everest. He died in 2023, having watched his Maytag mask catch on and help a generation of mountaineers reach new heights. Discover this object and more at the new National Geographic Museum of Exploration opening summer 2026. Visit moe.nationalgeographic.org. In the April 2026 issue of National Geographic, the National Geographic 33 honors a group of extraordinary people who are rising to meet the most critical challenges of our time, making meaningful progress and incredible breakthroughs. To highlight some of the more well-known honorees, Harrison Ford. It may surprise you to learn that Harrison Ford has a species of snake named after him, Tachymenoides Harrison Fordi, a rare breed of slender snake native to the Andes, just 16 inches long. Harmless. Researchers found it in 2022 sunbathing in an alpine swamp. There's an ant named for Ford, too. Phidoli Harrison Fordi, found primarily in Central America, and a spider. Calpurnia Harrison Fordi, mostly in California, eats other spiders. He could have had his name on a Tanzanian butterfly, but demurred, suggesting scientists name it instead after his daughter Georgia. It's hard to come up with Latin names for all the new species being discovered, Ford says, half grinning and half grimacing, sitting in his home office in Los Angeles. I guess they have to pin it on somebody. Ford is 83, and by now nearly 50 years since coming to fame playing Han Solo in Star Wars. His incapacity to take a compliment without a gruff wisecrack is the stuff of legend. But come on, there's no Tachymenoides Mark Hamilly or Phidoli Carrie Fishery, that's because scientists in the field know that Ford has spent decades championing biodiversity. For the past 35 years, he served as the public face of Conservation International, where he's currently vice chairman and whose mission he describes as saving life on Earth, basically. Instead of enjoying a restful retirement, Ford is working harder than people half his age. He spent much of last year shooting the third season of his Emmy-nominated therapist sitcom, Shrinking. When he's not acting, he's joining his CI colleagues in boardrooms with high-profile leaders, such as French President Emmanuel Macron, petitioning for urgent resources to fight wildfires in Brazil, for commitments to conservation frameworks like the UN's High Seas Treaty, and more. His superstar clout helps bring to the table the kind of state-level decision-makers necessary to accomplish anything of global consequence. And the depth of his commitment, the knowledge that he's no one-off celebrity spokesperson, that he'll be back in a year to follow up, helps hold them to account. Both the Amazon fires and the High Seas Treaty were at issue last fall when CI leaders met with Macron and other international delegations during the Climate Week NYC conference. It was Ford's first time in high-level meetings alongside CI's interim executive director, Daniela Rake, who took the position last summer and was struck by Ford's knowledge and preparation. He wants to sit down before each meeting and go through what are our priorities, what is the outcome we want for this meeting, Rake says. He wants to game out and even sort of rehearse how that's going to go. Does that sound an awful like running lines with the guy who played Indiana Jones? Rake laughs. It's not quite that, but it does feel like his day job is about being prepared, so that's how he engages with Conservation International as well. Ford is shrewdly aware of his utility to an organization like CI. He knows that even heads of state want to say yes to Han Solo. But he also knows his star power ain't enough, that it's on him to do what Han Solo can't, to articulate the urgent stakes of conservation work. People are sick to death of celebrity, I believe, he says, but they recognize truth when they see it and when they hear it. One truth he is espousing often lately, that it's time for the older generation of climate and conservation warriors to make way for a new crop of leaders with new ideas about advancing the cause. They are more fearless, more connected to the earth, and more capable of changing power than we ever were, he told an audience last fall, accepting a legacy award from the E.O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation, where he's also been a board member since 2010. We just need to get out of their way. The curmudgeonly Ford emerges only when pressed to describe why he feels such passion for conservation, seemingly loath to come off corny or sentimental. He rubs his eyes, pauses. We simply cannot provide for ourselves the things that nature gives us for free and that sustain our lives, he says finally. Then he drives home the point. Fresh water, clean air, pollinators for our crops, potential new undiscovered medicines and cures for things that ail us, food on our tables. They're not things that we can provide for ourselves. As for what's on his docket with Conservation International in the year ahead, he finds it much easier to reply. Everything, he says, everything that needs to be done. Written by Devin Gordon. Another well-known figure in the National Geographic 33 is actress Shailene Woodley. This article was written by Carrie Batan. In the age of hashtag activism, Shailene Woodley knows all too well the potential pitfalls of celebrity advocacy, which is why in 2019, when Greenpeace approached her to join an expedition to collect microplastics in the Sargasso Sea, she laid out her concerns before agreeing to partake. This can't be just a one and done. She's on a boat and it's sexy and let's take the photo and post it on Instagram. Instead, Woodley wanted to know what Greenpeace's plan of action was. If I put my energy towards something, it's because I know I can actually do something, she says. And Woodley has, in fact, done things. The actress, known for a rich portfolio of roles in everything from the Divergent series, has joined a Greenpeace mission and publicly stumped for a critical United Nations Ocean Protection Agreement, which became international law earlier this year. She has put her on-screen talents to use in conservation-driven documentaries and shows, and yes, some social media. And in the mold of Jane Fonda, Woodley has made the time within her hectic Hollywood career to participate in grassroots activism, as when she protested the Dakota Access Pipeline construction in 2016. She's also, for more than a decade, remained steadfast in her desire to produce tangible change beyond photo ops, especially in the realm of ocean conservation. The Sargasso Sea expedition was part of Greenpeace's larger efforts to support the High Seas Treaty, a global agreement 2 decades in the making that will establish legal frameworks to protect international marine areas. As a Greenpeace Oceans ambassador, Woodley lobbied tirelessly to get it passed. She spoke to policymakers, participated in some film segments that were directed at UN officials, and spoke to UN officials, says Arlo Hemphill from Greenpeace. She very much made herself part of the team. The treaty will help further a long-standing goal to give protected status to 30% of the world's high seas by 2030. It's a sign of one massive leap into progress in the future, Woodley says. There's a lot of big international momentum. Woodley has gotten pinned as a new age type, but her conservation work springs from a deep passion fostered at a young age. A true Southern California kid, she always felt at home in the water and has described her relationship to the ocean as spiritual. The granddaughter of a naturopath, she also grew up studying the health benefits of different plants before finding ways to merge a lifelong relationship with nature and her career. The next film Woodley is releasing, Ultra, a psychological thriller about an ultramarathoner, required intense outdoor training. Selfishly, she says, some of my favorite experiences on film sets have been when I've gotten to work in nature. While landing major movies throughout her 20s, Woodley began canvassing voters in rural communities across California. Through that work, she developed a network of organizer friends involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, who exposed her to the nitty-gritty world of grassroots advocacy. My friends are on the ground grinding and just hitting wall after wall and not giving up, Woodley says. And the thing that exhilarates me is being able to support them in that journey. She turned her attention to ocean conservation after joining Greenpeace in 2019 and learning more about the High Seas Treaty. While filming the Mauritanian in 2021 in South Africa, Woodley partnered with a nonprofit to lobby for an expansion of that country's protected marine areas from 5 to 10%, which she says helped bring a lot of attention to preservation work being done in South Africa. Lately, documentaries have also offered Woodley a megaphone. In 2024, she appeared in PBS's Hope in the Water episode about overfishing and alternative seafood options, which led to an uptick in sales for some of the sustainably sourced seafood products featured in the series. Whether she's on the ground or on camera, Woodley avoids invective or outrage in favor of appealing to people on a more fundamental level. If somebody is not familiar with who I am or my work or my history, then I sit there and I just explain it to them from a very human-based place, she says. It's on us to do something about this. You might not love me or know me, but we're in this room together. So how do we create a solution? That's all we have time for today. Thank you for joining me. I'm Susan from the Talking Information Center with articles from National Geographic's April, May, and March issues in 2026. A reminder that National Geographic is opening its Museum of Exploration, expected to open this summer of 2026 in Washington, D.C. To find out more details on exhibitions and events at the museum, go to moe.nationalgeographic.org.
This is Bird Note. Hummingbirds use their long tongues to sip nectar from flowers. They're able to roll their tongues into a tube-like shape. Since the 1800s, scientists thought those tongues worked through capillary action, like how water instantly rises into a straw in a full cup. This happens passively. The water is attracted to the surface, against gravity. But when scientists spent years using slow-motion cameras to capture hummingbirds drinking in greater detail, they uncovered a completely different story. The tongues aren't just passively drawing up nectar. They act like a tiny but powerful pump. Basically, hummingbirds use their tongues a bit like a bulb syringe or baster. First, the hummingbird flattens the tongue before putting it in the nectar. Then, once in contact with the liquid, the tongue expands, sucking the nectar inside. Finally, the hummingbird whips the tongue back to drink the mouthful. The whole process repeats many times per second. Actively pumping their nectar lets hummingbirds drink about 3 times faster than if they just used their tongues like straws. While it's a surprising adaptation, it's no surprise to find that the tongues of hummingbirds are just as busy as their bodies. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Hi, the Bay State Council of the Blind has available free Braille copies of a new publication from the CDC. It's entitled COVID-19 Vaccination Guidance, and this one-volume publication focuses on information about the vaccines and vaccine safety. To get your free copy, send your name and mailing address to kim.charlson@perkins.org. That's kim.charlson@perkins.org.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.